Now we both kinda like it. Now we both kinda know that if we're ever gonna make it, we just need to let go.
You're listening to the Crosscutting Concerns podcast. I'm your host, Matt Groves. Please visit the site at crosscuttingconcerns.com, where you can subscribe, browse the archives, contact me, read show notes, and leave a comment. I'm recording this podcast on September 11th, 2017. My guest today is Director of Developer Relations with Smartsheet and overall Internet Busybody, Ted Neward. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Doing great. Thanks for being on the show. How do you pronounce AKKA, A-K-K-A? I've only ever read it.
As far as I know, the pronunciation is AKKA with the more full-sounding AH sound, AKKA.
AKKA is one of those tools that's been on my to-learn list for a while. I keep hearing about it. I don't quite know what it is, and that's why I wanted to have you on to talk about it. Can you give me just like an elevator pitch for AKKA?
So fundamentally, AKKA is an attempt to bring the actor model style of execution that was so popular in the Erlang programming platform and language over to the Java virtual machine. It was sort of an outgrowth of some of the actor implementation that was originally bundled with Scala. But just the actors themselves became of great interest to people, even those who weren't interested in using Scala. So the TypeSafe guys, who are now called Lightbend, they essentially put a phenomenal amount of work into building out this library such that it can be accessed from either sort of its native Scala or using, you know, because Scala, of course, runs on top of the JVM, you can use a Java-based API as well to create actors, consume them, etc.
Now, you mentioned actor model there. What does that actually mean?
The actor model is effectively an attempt to try to get programmers to reason about concurrency more effectively without tremendous cognitive load. The big problem, I mean, anybody who's done any sort of Java development whatsoever generally at some point runs into java.lang.thread and thinks, oh, this looks cool. I think I'll try this because I hear that multi-threading helps make my programs go faster. Inevitably, they run into a situation where multiple threads are hammering on the same piece of data, and that's when they discover about the synchronized keyword, you know, be able to create synchronized blocks. And then they start learning about object monitors. And then they start learning about, well, if you lock too much, your program basically runs slower than if it were single-threaded. By this point, their head is starting to hurt, and the fun is only beginning for developers. Because now, as soon as you introduce multiple threads into your program, now you have to reason about every possible thread touching every possible line of code at the same time as every other possible thread. And quite frankly, there are only a few people in the world who can actually do that with any degree of accuracy. Anybody who thinks they can really needs to go read Java Concurrency in Practice by Brian Goetz, because most of the people who can do that well were the authors on that book and a few other people who were reviewers on that book, and the rest of us are just desperately trying to keep track. The actor model is not threads. The idea is you have actors, which are not really the same as objects, although they look very similar. And actors communicate with one another through the passing of messages. And this is effectively how Erlang works. But where in a standard JVM, you may be thinking, I'll spin up, you know, maybe a couple hundred threads, which, depending upon the hardware, could conceivably bring the JVM to a crawl. In an actor's model environment, you are thousands, millions, if you will, of these things. And the idea is the programmer doesn't think anymore about how do I map to threads and how do I deal with locking. It's more about passing messages around, and these actors are designed to be explicitly lightweight, very cheap to create, very cheap to tear down, and they don't carry a lot of the overhead that you get with threads. That's a very, very high surface level view. There's a lot of things, I'm sure, that Jonas over at TypeSafe would get kind of like, well, he's sort of right, sort of wrong. That's kind of the high level view, is to say, let's go to a more lightweight message passing style than our thread-based method invocation style that, quite frankly, has gotten a lot of people into a lot of trouble over the years.
Yeah, you're not kidding. I remember just doing something really, really simple with threads on an Android app or something. Just something incredibly simple, like a hello world, and even that was a nightmare to actually figure out what was going on, the race conditions, things like that.
Yeah, part of the problem here is simply that trying to reason about threads, because normally when we look at code, when we read left to right, top to bottom, the code proceeds in that manner. As soon as you start throwing threads into the discussion, threads can execute at any point, anywhere. And so now all of a sudden, you've got one thread that's starting to execute at the top of this particular function while another thread's there at the bottom of the function. But part of the problem for us is that the gods of computer science are twisted and malignant souls, and they schedule the CPU, they schedule the threads in whatever way that will be the most malignant to us at that given moment in time. So, for example, if you're running it on your machine during a standard debugging session, they will make sure everything flows perfectly wonderful. You will get nothing but happy path scheduling. And then as soon as you show the code to your boss, or worse, if you show it in a demo, the gods in their evil and twisted way will start rearranging the thread execution so that now all of those bugs that you had lurking there, but you'd never seen when you were running it on your machine, now they will all come to the fore. Now it will completely deadlock, or worse, the data will be corrupted. They are an evil, twisted lot. It's extremely difficult for programmers to be able to reason about all of the possible ways this can go wrong. It's a permutative thing.
So you also mentioned Erlang. I want to mention an earlier episode of Cross-Cutting Concerns with Coral Rausch. We talked about Erlang, so I'll put a link to that in the show notes. I'm just trying to get my head wrapped around Akka here. Where does it actually run? Is there like an Akka server? Does it run within the app? I saw somewhere on the Akka website that it was distributed in some way. How does that actually work?
Akka fundamentally is just a library. So it is simply a way of creating actors in the same way that for a long time objects were sort of a library on top of procedural languages. You could create things that looked like objects and behaved like objects. Akka is the same way. There is a base class that you can inherit from. There are objects that you instantiate that represent how you interact with the Akka environment. Where Akka gets the distribution capabilities is that if I'm sending a message, I don't really care in some respects. I mean, I do to some degree and I don't to some degree. All I know from a programmatic perspective is I'm sending a message. Now, whether that message is to another actor within the same Java virtual machine, or whether that message is to an actor all the way across the world via the internet, from a programming perspective, I don't care. Now, the key thing here is we've had other technologies in the past where we said, oh, yeah, it's all completely transparent. You don't have to worry about the network. And Akka is not necessarily trying to hide the network away so much as they are trying to make it easier for developers to think about making that move to distribution. When you get into a message passing scenario, you're not dealing quite as much with the ORPC sort of thing that we had with CORBA and DCOM and to some degree with web services. It's more about saying the message can travel over a variety of different media. In the super fast case, it's traveling just in memory. It's going into a small message queue associated with the actor who can then process that message and move on. In the distributed case, now those message queues are running on a separate machine. Yes, it can be a server. The message just appears and you keep processing as per what you've been doing before. So it's trying to be something of a unified programming model, but it's not trying to suggest that we can ignore the network because there are all kinds of failure scenarios that you have to deal with. And that's something that Akka very much wants you to be forced to deal with, right? You should be thinking about what happens if I send a message to that server over there and it gets lost, which is, you know, surprisingly often. And now how do I respond? How do I deal with that? It's just a library, but that library abstraction allows us to distribute across multiple machines when we're ready and able to.
You mentioned queuing systems. Is Akka comparable to something like RabbitMQ? Does it store data on its own then, or is it something different?
It's not the same as a RabbitMQ from a lot of the details perspective, but from a conceptual perspective, yes, sort of. With a traditional message queuing system, there's a lot more emphasis on looking at the queues, seeing the messages, pulling those out. And those things which process the messages are kind of a, you have things that are pulling messages out of queue, whatever, that's nice. With Akka, the emphasis is more on the actors, and the fact that we're using messages is almost an implementation detail. I mean, you see the idea that you're sending a message that is, you know, effectively an API call. you're receiving messages within the actor. That's an API call. But beyond that, we don't worry so much about the queues themselves as we do in like a RabbitMQ. In some respects, and I don't know if the Akka guys have gotten there, but in some respects, if you could imagine Akka being written in such a way to use RabbitMQ under the hood, that's probably the closest way to think about how those two might relate to one another.
I'm trying to wrap my head around when I could get some benefit out of Akka. So let's just start simple. Would there be any benefit if I'm doing some sort of simple forms over data CRUD web application?
Probably not, from the standpoint that that's typically a single user scenario. Now, if you say, I want to build a forms over data that is sending data off and there's potentially billions of us and I don't necessarily need to see the result of that data being processed, only to know that it is entered into a queue to be processed. Now we start getting into more of a scenario where this becomes interesting, becomes useful. And in some respects, that probably has greater application than most people imagine. When you sit down and place an order with Amazon, for example, and you fill out the book that you're interested in, you fill out your credit card details, and you hit submit, you don't actually see the results of that transaction for, in some cases, 3 or 4 days, right, when the book finally shows up at your doorstep. There is an intrinsic asynchronous processing model that goes on there. They take your credit card information, they say it was submitted successfully, and then, well, at some point, for example, they don't want to charge your card right away, because if the book's out of stock, then you're paying interest for 6 weeks, and yeah, Amazon's, you know, pretty good about that. They'll charge your card when they get ready to pull the book off the shelf and send it to you. But by that point, your card may, in fact, no longer be valid. Maybe you got hacked. Maybe you closed the account down. Maybe you just forgot how much money you had on the card. Whatever. At that point, they'll send you a message back saying, hey, there was a problem processing your credit card, at which point you can deal with that. Under the hood, even though when we're on the Amazon website, we are dealing very much with a client-server, client-request-server response kind of interaction model, HTTP, intrinsically from an architectural perspective, you're dropping a message to be processed elsewhere. If your website is such that you could think about if that might make sense for you, then certainly you could have a traditional, you know, Java servlet, JSP, whatever, front end, that takes information from the user and then says, all right, cool, now I want to spray this out to the rest of my system in an asynchronous fashion because I'm going to have lots and lots and lots of these going on. Then, absolutely, it makes total sense. But it's not designed as a replacement for like HTTP. It's not designed as a replacement for objects. It's really geared for more of this, I know I'm going to be in a very fairly highly concurrent processing scenario. And so if you look at your problem and say, yeah, I'm not sure that this is really concurrency friendly, then Akka's probably not going to be a great choice.
I'm just trying to maybe nail down some rules of thumb to know if I'll get any benefit from Akka. Most developers I know are somewhere between the simple forms over data CRUD and Amazon. If I'm doing a lot of processing that might be better off in the background, would Akka benefit me there? Just to move some logic from the web request itself off to some background worker? Is that what we're getting at here?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things that can happen in the background as a part of processing. And part of the underlying goal for the original Erlang implementation was a very heavy emphasis on resiliency. Erlang originally, the language name supposedly derives from Ericsson's language. According to legends and lore, Joe Armstrong built this when he was working for Ericsson, which is, of course, the mobile phone company. And legend holds that if you make a mobile phone call anywhere in Europe, your packets, your data is traveling over an implementation of Erlang. And when you start talking about mobile telecommunications, you really have to get to 99.9% reliability. That means the system has to be up 99.999% of the time. By the way, that translates over a given year. That translates to less than 5 minutes of downtime, scheduled or unscheduled. You know, as soon as you start getting to large scale, you have to go to large concurrency models. I mean, those two really just go hand in hand. And as soon as you go there, the chances are that things will go wrong as part of the processing. If you talk about your Amazon.com and you want to be able to process incoming requests, you start saying, okay, well, we've got 100,000 people who are all trying to order books at the same time. what can we do to make sure this system stands up, can actually recover on its own? What happens if one of these actors along the way falls over? And, you know, I want to sometimes take actors and cluster them together. And this is part of the difference between Akka and going back to your earlier question with RabbitMQ. RabbitMQ, those message queuing systems are like messaging in the large. Akka allows you to be able to do this at a much more fine-grained level. For example, we talk about the website and you want to be able to take a change to somebody's status. One of the things you might do is rather than going and looking up the data from the database, pulling out that person's status, making the change and then pushing it back as a transaction. With Akka, what you might say is, all right, so Joe wants to change his status from online to offline. So I'm going to send a message to the status processing actor, and that actor will capture that message. It will see that Joe wants to change his status and will turn that into the necessary database interaction, but over there on that other actor. If for whatever reason we need to know that that was successfully processed, we can put that actor under a supervisor who can make sure that if that actor dies for whatever reason, let's assume there's a network exception, JDBC exception that gets thrown as part of that, supervisor can say, oh, that actor died. Let me fire up another actor of the same type, feed it the same message, and it can continue to replay. You know, a lot of this emphasis here is around resiliency combined with the concurrency, and this starts to get us down this whole notion of reactive programming. It's not a really easy A, B kind of, you know, do you need this? Yes, no. But part of the thing is the Akka guys will tell you most modern systems really could benefit from this degree of resiliency. Most systems that need to scale could benefit from this degree of concurrency. And so to a certain degree, yeah, everybody needs it. But to a certain degree, yeah, probably not everybody needs it. Okay. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sounds like a typical architect answer to me. It depends.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time, you know, doing a lot of architecture and doing a lot of consulting. Those two things have a tendency to go together.
We've already mentioned Erlang, and I know there's a .NET implementation called Akka.NET. Are there any other alternatives or competitors that you're aware of out there?
There's dozens. Microsoft Research did one at one point called Orleans. Of course, you know, the Erlang implementation, there are several different languages that are starting to make use of Erlang as a platform. There was a Java-based one at one point, I think it was called JErlang or something. And then in the .NET world, I think there was an implementation called Retlang. And there have been a number of other academic implementations that have been floating around. And if we say that the principal thing that Akka does is message passing, you know, forget the actors for just a second, but if the principal thing is message passing, we can go all the way back to Smalltalk. That's actually the thing that Alan Kay was, you know, he was surprised when everybody sort of jumped on the object side of things. To him, the most interesting part of Smalltalk was the fact that it was a message passing system, which Objective-C picked up and used for a long time. So anytime you pick up an iPhone and start playing around with some of those apps that have been in place since iPhone 1, you're intrinsically doing a lot of message passing back and forth between more traditional objects. But even your standard GUI, your standard user interface, if you fire up Windows, if you fire up the Mac, what's happening down there is deep in the bowels of the system, there is a thread called the event loop. And all it's doing is it's spinning around and gathering all these little data points from the hardware. Every time you push the key down, every time you let the key go, every time the mouse changes its position on the screen, it's turning that into a message and firing that at whatever window happens to be currently in focus and or under the mouse at that particular time. If you drill deeply enough through some of these UI toolkits, you'll find that fundamentally we've been doing this message passing thing for years, months, decades. The concept of message passing is a very common and old one. Akka and Erlang are basically elevating that a little bit more into the programmer's mindset. Are they competitors to Akka? No, but there's a lot of ideas around this concept of message passing. It just kind of depends on how broadly you want to draw the borders.
We're kind of running short on time here, but I wanted to ask you if you had used Akka before. What did you use it for and how did it go?
At a previous firm, we were actually using Akka to build a data transformation pipeline. One of the things that Akka can be really, really good for is, particularly combined with Scala, is for doing sort of ETL type processing. The Lake Washington School District, called the Puget Sound Educational Services District, they actually work with seven of the school districts here in the Seattle area. And in particular, there is the state who has their system of record for students, and then there are these four different student information systems that are used by the seven school districts in the area. And as you can well imagine, five different systems of record for student information means that a student transferring from one district to another is going to require some sneaker net, you know, or some manual typing, some swivel chair net as people look at one screen and type it into the other. And they wanted a system basically to do that transformation on the order of seconds rather than days, weeks, or months. We built basically a simple actor pipeline that said, we're going to ingest the record from one of these four. We're going to turn it into a common intermediate representation, and then we're going to do a transform into the target system of record. And each of these was run as a separate actor type. We could stand up however many of these, because, of course, this is a system that is going to have very variable load. In August, right before school starts, that's the peak season. And that's when you need that those transfers to be going through relatively quickly, but at a much, much broader scale. During the months of, well, you know, in many cases, the remainder of the school year, there was really not a lot of load, period. And so we could control via the number of actors in this pipeline exactly how much concurrency we needed.
What resources would you recommend for someone who wants to get started with ACCA or the actor model?
There's two general places I would go. One is, of course, just about anything written by Joe Armstrong. He's the guy who created Erlang. He's kind of the go-to guy for a lot of thoughts around that. And since Erlang was sort of the poster child for actor models, he's at least your gateway into a lot of the other more academic levels of things. The ACCA website itself is a tremendously good bundle of information. There's a lot of good text. What is an actor model? Why do you care? Why don't current programming techniques currently suffice? So I would definitely go to ACCA.io. I would definitely look up Joe Armstrong. And there's a lot of academic papers out there that talk about message passing in general. But those two are probably the key places to start. And if you really want to dive more into the theory and whatnot, there's a bucket load of reading you can go look at.
I'll put those links into the show notes at crosscuttingconcerns.com. Is there anything else you'd like to promote before we wrap up the show?
Well, I suppose my employer would say if you've not checked out Smartsheet, you should go do that. But other than that, I'm good.
My guest today has been Ted Neward. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, sir.
This has been the Cross-Cutting Concerns podcast, produced and recorded by Matt Groves 2017. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it on social media and leave a review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you downloaded this podcast. For show notes, please go to crosscuttingconcerns.com. This episode is recorded under the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license. Hosting for this podcast was made possible in part by Microsoft. It was recorded and mixed with the help of Audacity, Skype, and Camtasia Recorder. The theme music is by The Dirty Truckers. You can buy the music on Amazon or iTunes. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on a future episode, please go to crosscuttingconcerns.com to submit your name and idea.